So tonight's talk is called Thoughts on Not-Self. Not-self being one of the three marks of existence, the three things that we have to realize, that things aren't the way we want them to be, that we suffer, sometimes naturally, sometimes because we create our own suffering. So things are unreliable, I suppose. Things are always changing. There's no solidity to anything, and that this idea of a separate self is illusory. The problem with this is that, we can sort of experience things changing all the time, and never there's no solidity there. We can sort of see impermanence, experience it in our practice, and just see it in our lives and world. And we can sort of see that suffering arises inevitably in our lives. Not that we don't have lots of joy too, but there's always this balance of what a friend of mine calls the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. But not self. The problem with not self is we're talking about something that is non-dual. And but we're talking about it and trying to figure it out while living in the world of duality. So we're trying to explain something that's non-dual using dual means, which is pretty much hopeless. So the thing about not self is it's something we have to experience, I suppose. We have to grok it, to use a Heinlein phrase from my old hippie days. But there are ways we can approach it, we can look at it, that help us sort of head in the right direction. And so what I want to do tonight is talk about these not self from three different perspectives, from three different sets of teachings in a sense, though they're all interrelated quite strongly. The first of these is language, how we use language, and how language creates a sense of a separate self over and over and over again. How just by the way we speak and the way we think of things that we experience, we create a sense of me, not me, over and over and over again, just by the language you use. And so there's this interesting list. It's like called 5 ways we think of ourselves as a self. So 5 ways where just by the language we use, we are creating separate self. We're one of my teachers called selfing. Okay. So the first one is that I am the body, which is pretty common. Like, yep, this is me for sure. It's my chest and my shoulder. So it's like the first one is how. Like, so someone asks you the question, "How old are you?" And you'll say something like, "Oh, Mike, I'm 77." Now I've just identified myself as this body. I am 77, and it's like, but of course, you go to some place where you have to, identify yourself, and they ask what your age is. You'd better know that you're 77. It's like in the world of duality, in the world of relative reality, it's something we have to know, who I am and how old I am and those sorts of things. But it immediately says, I am the body. I am this object that's 77 years old. That's me. I am 77. I am. Or it could be not so much I am the body as I own the body. Someone says, "Well, what color are your eyes?" And I'd answer, "Well, my eyes are blue. My, I own those eyes, and they're blue." Once again, creating the sense of self by simply responding to a normal everyday question. Like my driver's license, I better know what color my eyes are, right? So it's once again what we need to know in terms of relative reality to function, but at the same time, we immediately create this self as something we own, something we possess. Another way we do this is through language is, saying something, I am my emotions, like I am happy, I am sad, I am angry, I, so that the emotion is who I am. I am that emotion, that emotional energy. I identify with it and it becomes who I am. I am, right now, I am sad. I am angry. I am happy. Once in language reinforces this idea of a separate self again. Or, it also in English we use it, it's more like, just like we own the body, we also own the emotions. My joys and sorrows. My. Once again, I possess it. These emotions and moods are something I possess. I possess. And then we have the last on this list is I can sort of go, yeah, I can see none of those are true. Well, we can sort of figure that out maybe. But then this, well, but I'm the one who sees all that. I'm the consciousness. It's just another way we define, I am my consciousness. That ability I have to see other, see things and cognize them, perceive them. That's who I am. So these are five different ways using language that we create a sense of a separate self. And so this is from Guy Armstrong's book called Emptiness, which is another word for not self, right? And he saw, to be honest with you, these five different ways I quite boldly stole from this book. But now I want you to hear what he has to say about this, these five things. We've now found five meanings for I, as the body, the owner of the body, the emotions, the owner of the emotions, and the observer. Which are you really? It's a pretty simple question. Which one are you? Do you have five different eyes? Right? You might reply, I'm all of them. I'm my body and it belongs to me. I'm my thoughts and feelings and they belong to me. And I'm something apart from them, watching it all. I'm everything you said, all wrapped up in one. Which might sound like a very valid answer. I'm all these things. We've now, and Guy goes on, we've now arrived at the conventional understanding of the self. In this culture, when I talk about what I am, it's this whole package. It's all these things. Right? We now arrive at a place where, upon looking closely, the absurdity of conventional understanding becomes apparent. Guy being very precise. How many cells are you? Are you a self as the organ of your liver and also the emotion of compassion? Are these the same I or different? Are you a self as your political view and also the consciousness you hear when you hear a bird call? Are these the same I or different? Are you a self who is changing every moment as the body does with its pulses, respiration, and digestion? Or are you an ongoing self who is the stable observer of the changes? Are these the same I or different? So you see what he's saying there? We have all these different, at various times and in various situations, we have very different ways of looking at who I am. and they're contradictory. They don't all, they can't all be the same I somehow or other. When we look into these questions, what we find are little more than collisions of unexamined language habits around I and my. One is reminded of the famous comment by Ludwig Wittgenstein, famous philosopher, that the self is only a shadow cast by grammar. Right. Wittgenstein is a famous philosopher, so that sounds like a very famous philosopher talking, right? But it's an interesting, you know. And the self is only a shadow cast by grammar. So it's just our language creates our sense of self. We found these terms useful to distinguish one person from another in social dialogue and to establish social guidelines about possessions. But by not examining the terms closely, we have stretched the idea of self so far that it does not actually make sense. There's too many different versions of I here in another little section here. It's fine to say I and mine, you and yours, as long as you understand that these terms are merely conventions of our social contract that identify where an activity is taking place or where ownership is assigned. With these useful conventions, you end up in your home and I end up in mine after driving our respective cars. Life would be too chaotic without these conventions and the language we use to communicate about them. So we can't live without language. You know, it's inherent in being human that we use language, whether it's written language or spoken language or sign language, but there's always language, right? Even like chimpanzees, they 500 some chimps earn like 500 different signs and could ask for a cookie and all those sorts of things. Language is inherent in being alive. But how can we put that together with the idea that we're not separate from everything else? How can we balance language and how we use language, which is always creating a sense of separation, because we're defining mine, not mine, me, not me, over and over and over again in our language. And it just keeps creating a sense of a separate self. Had a teacher once who suggested that you try for a day to spend the whole day, a normal day out where you're dealing with other people and just situations as life stuff, and not use the words I, me, my, or mine ever for a whole day. It's really hard to do. I mean, unless you sort of go hide in a cave for a day, but even then you're thinking, oh, that's my thoughts, my cave. Right? So it's pretty difficult to do away with this. But this is something from Guy that I learned. It's a little way of seeing if we can use language in a way that doesn't create or reinforce the sense of a separate self. So this is I am a part of the ever-changing flow of experience, of things constantly arising and passing away, conventionally known as Barry. So there's no possession here, right? I am a part of the ever-changing flow of experience, of things constantly arising and passing away, conventionally known as Barry. So you can have a sense of self in the relative world, but you have to, can we have one with this being the context of how we think about it? Where there's no separate I there. Other than, of course, in the sentence itself, I. Starts with I. Right? but it's like, how can I have a relative reality sense that isn't based on separateness, that it just acknowledges, because this is really what's true. We're just part of this constant flow of change that's going on all the time, that has somehow got separated out and had this label called Barry stuck on it for a while. And then, like everything else, it's arisen, it's going to be here for a while, and then it's going to be gone. It's just another thing that arises and doesn't last. So if we can always be acknowledging that, that that's all we are, then we're not separating ourselves, we're not creating a sense of self so strongly. So there's just one way of looking at this idea of not self. One way we can sort of see how we keep creating this sense of a separate self over and over again through language, and how we could potentially gently, it's just that, you know, can you imagine saying, hi, my name is George, who are you? And I respond, I'm a part of the ever-changing. Socially, it might be a little difficult, right? But it's like, it's within our own thought process, it might be a skillful thing to remind ourselves frequently that that's the case. So that's one view. There's another interesting view, and this is like totally going off in another direction. This is a book called The Zen of Therapy, Uncovering a Hidden Kindness in Life by Mark Epstein, MD. Mark Epstein is a very famous psychologist, therapist, but he's also has been for many, many years a meditator. He has been a student of Joseph Goldstein's for like 40 odd years, and his whole thing is to combine Freudian, he's a Freudian psychotherapy, with Dhamma and seeing how they fit together. And this is a little section of what he's talking about, and that I think is it's interesting that he even attempts to do this, I think. And so I want to talk about these things that he's saying here, because I think they're quite relevant. And he's talking about not no self or not self. The heart of the Buddha's message is that there is no self. What we mean by that is open to interpretation, and there's been no end to debate about it over the centuries. So in different schools of Buddhism, let me tell you, this is like a hot topic. Everybody has their own idea of what this means, right? That's what it's referring to here. But however we choose to understand it, there is no question that we are getting at something profound, difficult to comprehend, and central to his teachings. Rather than digging too deeply into the endless academic debates about this core doctrine, where the language of philosophy threatens to overwhelm the felt truth of this bold statement, let's stay close to the actual words. There is no self. How strange. I don't know whether you react the same way I do, but I actually find this relieving. If I don't have a self, then I don't just put all that energy into maintaining it. How much time and energy we put into maintaining a sense of being separate. I mean, that's the relieving part. It's also the scary part. Deep down, I've never been sure that I had a self, or enough of a self, or the right kind of self, or that my self was okay, or that it was even there. Remember, this is a psychotherapist speaking, but it's like, have you experienced any of those in your life? I'm so sure that I had a self, or enough of a self, or the right kind of self, or my self was okay, or that it was even there. This is a pretty normal human experience, right? What self? I look at my parents and they had selves. I looked at my friends and siblings and they had selves. I looked at the other boys in my class and they seemed to have selves. And the girls, No question, definitely had self. But my own self was hard to pin down. There were swirls of thoughts and feelings for sure, and certainly a recurrent sense of inadequacy coupled with the wish to please, and happiness when I was praised, or pride when I was successful at something. But from an early age, I had a nagging kind of doubt that I, when I compared myself with those around me, not self-doubt as much as doubts about my own completeness. How I seemed from the inside did not match up with how other people appeared from the outside. Was I who I'm supposed to be, or was I somehow wanting? There wasn't much I could do with this question. I pretty much had to bury it and just pretend. Now that I'm a psychiatrist and I've been treating people for 40 years, I know that these kinds of feelings are far from unique. In one form or another, they might even be the norm. So this is for the psychological perspective that not only do we have a self, but it isn't enough. It's not a good self. It's not perfect, somehow or other. And he then goes and he talks from a Freudian point of view with three ways we create this sense of a self that isn't adequate. Remember, this is Freudian psychology here, so if what I say here makes you squirm a bit, it makes me squirm sometimes too, but it's just interesting that he approaches it from this angle. And then he comes back and ties this all together. So, first of all, Freud said that one way we create, very early on, create a sense of a separate self is young children's sexual feelings towards their parents, coupled with a sense of an inadequacy of not being good enough. And this had to do partly with comparing their bodies to their parents' bodies. Like their body obviously wasn't like their parents' bodies, therefore they weren't adequate. They weren't enough. They weren't like them. And this was like, from a Freudian point of view, a built-in part of being a child and growing up. And this would be not often even conscious. This isn't like a conscious experience. This isn't something that little kids sit around and think about. It's just that's their perception of things. Okay. Unbridled anger at caregivers who could never be enough or give enough. You know, think of a 4-year-old wanting something, and dad or mom, or dad and mom are busy, and what does the 4-year-old do? Freaks out and has a tantrum. Like, I want this, I want it now, and they're saying, no, you'll have to wait. You know, give me a minute while I finish. You know, making supper or, you know, fixing this fence or whatever is going on. And so the child starts to think they're not their self, whatever their self is, isn't adequate. Because I'm not getting enough attention. Which is inevitable for a small child. It's like part of being a small child. And then there's a whole other branch of this psychological teaching called attachment theory, where there needs to be a good enough parent, letting kids learn about life without being too intrusive or too abandoning or too chaotic. These are all things that parents, without realizing it, I'm not saying they're bad parents or something like that, but they're either too intrusive, they want to sort of have too much control over the kid's life, or too abandoning, like this, like, no, I'm too busy, you just do whatever you want to do, or too chaotic, like that, you know, some households can be quite chaotic, just because the parents are chaotic, then it creates it. And all of these are ways, once again, where children in these experiences over and over again in within the construct of family, keep getting a sense that they're not good enough, that their self isn't the way it should be. And this is just what happens, okay? And this is, and then what happens is what Mark Epstein has to say. And they all of these theories are about feeling, what we feel, not like physical sensation feeling, but emotions, moods, those sorts of things. And so now Mark goes on. All of these theories, so cogent and persuasive, treat underlying feelings of doubts about the self as pathological, and seek to explain them, not by obliquely finding someone or something to blame. As you can see from the various examples recounted in this book, I found each of these models helpful in individual cases, but I do not think it's necessary to pathologize the entire phenomenon of doubts about the self. Pretty radical for a Freudian psychologist to say. Who gets out of their childhood intact? Who gets out of their childhood intact? It's a really interesting question, you see. When we presume that a core self exists, when we presume that a separate self exists, we are forced to consider intimations of no self as a sign, as signs of emotional illness or developmental lapse. So you go around and tell people you don't have a separate self. In most of the world, in society, you'd be like, well, this guy's gone off the deep end one way or another, right? And industry is made out of blaming one's mother for such feelings, as if every existence is proof of a parent's deficiency. The Buddhist teachings run counter to this tendency to find fault. So, yes, all these things are, you know, I was just describing from, you know, the Freudian point of view, all happen. But it's no one's fault. You know, casting fault and blame just sort of perpetuates it, right? The Buddhist teachings run counter to this tendency to find fault. He normalized feelings of inadequacy and threw the responsibility back onto the individual to sort them out. He taught mindfulness as a method of probing the self and found that impartial attention to moment-to-moment experience yields surprising but predictable insight into the self's contingent and relational nature. These insights, which precipitate spontaneously out of concentrated attention and mindful reflection, make abundantly clear that our habitual efforts to defend ourselves against our intrinsic groundlessness makes things even worse. Right. And we do this all the time. Think about, you know, when someone, you know, says something about you that you don't like. What do? You then defend yourself, have to get back at them somehow or other, or prove that they're wrong. Which just creates more suffering for you and the other person, right? As Samuel Beckett once put it, the ego, minister of dullness, is also an agent of security. But the Buddhist view is that good enough can never be good enough, that there's always a leftover feeling of something missing, something wrong, something hard to face, or something out of reach, and this can be beneficial as it prompts a search for the real. So no matter what we do, if we're looking for things in the world of relative reality that are going to make us happy, it never works. For all these reasons. Even with good enough upbringing and the consolidation of what might be called the good enough self, according to the Buddha's logic, there will still be disquiet, confusion, and insecurity, because all of that, all we are instinctively struggling to be something independent, solid, coherent, and self-sufficient, we can never be. We can never be independent, solid, coherent, and self-sufficient. That's really something to take in from a psychological point of view. Even in healthy personality development, we emerge from childhood defending against the underlying truth of how contingent, provisional, and dependent we actually are. The persistence of such feelings, far from being a symptom of parental failures, even if there have been such failures, is actually the seed of wisdom. Fighting against them only rigidifies our defenses and isolates us further. Acknowledging the emptiness that frightens us, whatever its source may be, is the key to a deeper and truer understanding. The emptiness we fear is not really empty. What it is, when it is successfully turned into an object of awareness, it reveals itself as vast, luminous, and reassuringly, albeit mysteriously, alive. So when we can let go of this sense of a separate self, which we are always, if we have that sense, defending, judging, comparing, which all of which cause suffering, if we can let go of that and just see the truth, not intellectually, experience the truth, probably a better word, of not self, then something else arises that's much deeper and profounder. And this is like a Freudian psychologist saying this, which I find interesting. So that's view number two. And then there's the more, I guess I could call it, I call it in my notes here, the traditional perspective. Traditional being tradition from the Buddhist teachings. And I want to read something from Ajahn Sumedho. This is a part of a huge collection of his Dharma talks at various times. This one is the third volume of his Dharma talks. It's called Direct Realization. One way of looking at what this practice leads to. And he's saying, ignorance conditions the karmic formations, i.e. body and mind as defined by the five khandhas, the five piles of stuff that we use to create a sense of a separate self. That is when we operate from a position of ignorance, not understanding the truth, and everything that we experience and do and say and feel is conditioned from that ignorance. Absolutely everything. So this is like the teaching on the five aggregates of clinging. And the whole essence of this teaching is that when we look closely at everything that we can experience, that we are experiencing all the time, we see that everything fits into one of these five piles, five heaps. And that there's no self in all of those piles. There's no self there. There's just things arising and passing away. Things constantly changing. And he said, it's this not seeing this is what he's calling ignorance. This is where the self view is such a blind spot. When we think of the karmic formation as self rather than as not self, everything that happens, everything that is experienced, is referred to that sense of a person, as a physical body, me as a perception. This is ignorance. If you have the insight that all conditions are impermanent, all Dhamma is not self, then there's knowing the truth or Dhamma rather than ignorance and habitual karma. There's knowing the Dhamma, the truth of the way it is. Then all the rest follows suit. Everything is seen as it is. There's no distortion. Consciousness, the five aggregates and the sense world are seen as Dhamma rather than as self. If you investigate, you can always trace it back to this ignorance. There's natural suffering, going hungry, getting old, getting sick, but that's all bearable. There's nothing we can't bear. Sickness and old age and death are things we always bear with. They're not real suffering. Suffering is the greed, hatred, and delusion we produce through self-view, through taking it all personally. The creations and attachments to wrong views, prejudices, biases, and all the horrors that we are responsible for can all be traced back to this view of a separate self. We can't really expect very much improvement if we still insist on being ignorant, caught in the self-view. Even though we might be able to improve conditions slightly by trying to be a good person, as long as there is attachment to self-view, there is delusion. So even the goodness we do comes from delusion. It doesn't lead anyone out of suffering. If we don't have wisdom, often we try to do good but end up harming and causing all kinds of problems while thinking we can tell others what is good for them. What is the way it is at this moment? Your body is sitting. You can feel things. Pleasure, pain, heat, cold, or whatever. This is the way things are. There's no self in that. We are not creating the self. When we bring our attention to the way things are, we can see what we do and what we add, me and mine, to the moment. What I think, what I feel, what I want, what I don't want, what I like, what I don't like. Or we can be aware of ourselves we create in others, my opinions about you. I have suffered a lot from creating people in my mind. Not because anybody was really cruel to me, but because of all the things I used to create about myself and about other people. The fear of what others thought, jealousies, envy, greed, possessiveness. I would have my prejudices and views about people, what I thought they were really up to, and my mind and my suspicions about what they really wanted. So suffering comes out of the creations we make about ourselves and others, about our parents and the people closest to us. What is suffering? Really, ask yourself, what is the suffering of your life? Yesterday the cold winds were blowing through me as I was walking out there in the field. Is that suffering? I can make it suffering. I could hate this cold wind. But actually, it was all right. I mean, it was something I could completely bear. If I didn't make anything about it in my mind, it was just cold wind. That's all. Yet we can spend time in the ashram creating attitudes about monks, nuns, and lay people. You can really make senior nuns into big ogres. We can have strong views about seniority. If we are in a senior position, then we can be very attached to it. I'm senior to you. You are just a new monk. Do that. I'm boss. So we can create ourselves as being senior monks. We are not here to create karma based on ignorance. The conventions we have are merely expedient means. They are simplifications, moral agreements, and community agreements to make life simple and uncomplicated, and also allow us to reflect on the way we can relate to people above, senior people, equal people, junior people. So we are constantly, he's talking about our problem of comparing, which is the other way we can create a sense of a separate self very quickly. So, you know, comparing, I don't have the verse right here, I think I have it in Joyce's book, we'll read. But basically, comparing what's in Buddhism is called conceit, really has three valences. There's I'm better than someone. Someone is better than me, or we're equal. And the thing about this is, in all three of those cases, the same thing is happening. There's me, not me. Me and what I'm, who, the person I'm comparing to, or the group of people I'm comparing to, or the country, or the football team, or whatever, some way we've divided things up. There's always a me and a not me. As soon as we compare, as soon as the comparing process, which seems so natural, starts, we're creating a sense of a separate self again. Me, not me. Me and who I'm comparing to. This is Joseph Goldstein. And this is talking about comparing as a cause of restlessness. Restlessness being one of the five kilesas. Comparing always makes us restless. That's what Joseph has to say. And how, you know, one aspect of restlessness that Joseph emphasizes here is worry. Worrying about things, right? Worry, too, manifests in different ways. Sometimes it is a form of remorse or regret about past unskillful actions or about skillful actions left undone. Sometimes we worry about some imagined future, about things that have not even happened. One friend spoke to me of obsessive worry about loved ones, but what might happen, even though everything was fine in the moment. So easy to do this. I see myself doing this around, what if I die first and my wife is left? Is she going to be able to take care of herself? You know, I'm just like, and you can, I can just go off on that for like half an hour. You just get caught up in that thought. What happens if? Who knows? I mean, that's like me trying to predict what's going to happen in the future. Good luck with that, right? But it's like what we do. We often worry about anticipated problems. I notice this come up in travel. The flight I'm on may be a little late, and I'm worried about whether I'll make the connection. Feeling some anxiety and tension, I find myself sitting in the seat, urging the plane to go faster. In situations like this, it's helpful to reflect that the worry has absolutely no bearing on the outcome. And I like that. Like, worry has no bearing on the outcome. We are simply making ourselves tense and miserable through whatever convenience there may be or may not be, or in effect saying, let's add a little suffering to the mix. Sometimes we worry about our practice. While goals and aspirations are key elements in our spiritual journey, the mind can easily be over-concerned about our progress, about how we think we're doing, obsessing about our enlightenment or lack of it. With this kind of worry, it's easy to fall into self-judgment, a certain kind of spiritual self-absorption. We start comparing ourselves to other meditators, the length of our sits, the amount of food we take, how slowly we're moving, and our minds can easily get agitated by this worry about our practice. We lose the simplicity of easeful resting in the moment, mindful of whatever is arising. Sound at all familiar? Joseph tells this great story. One of the first long retreats he's on in India, there was a men's dorm and a women's dorm. And the men's dorm, they didn't, it was just like a big room with sort of like little separators between the beds. So there were like little alcoves where you had your little space, but there's no doors. And the separators didn't even go up to the roof, so the light could travel in all directions. And he became convinced that he was going to be the best meditator, right? And he was going to stay up later than anybody else and study and practice. And there he'd be sitting in his little cubicle, and about three cubicles down, someone else would have their light on. And he was always like, no, I have to stay up later than that guy down there. And he could never do it. Eventually he'd just be like reading with his eyes closed or whatever, and he'd have to go to sleep. But he was always like worried about, he wasn't quite good, and he was comparing himself to this other amazing guy who always stayed up even later than him, right? So, and at the end of the retreat, he actually met this person who he hadn't known before. And he was talking, and he was saying, he sort of said, you know, every night I tried to stay up as much as you did, but your light was always on, and I had to turn my light off and go to sleep. And the guy looked at him kind of funny and said, oh, I just slept with my light on. And all of his worry and all of his agitation, caught up in comparing himself to this other guy, was just like, oh, what nonsense. Just like that. There's a story that had no true meaning, right? The thing about not self, and I want to emphasize this, is this is something we can't figure out, which is our nature. We want to figure it out somehow. If I just think about it enough, I'll think. And that's not hopefully what I've done to you in talking about for the last 40 minutes or so. These are hopefully just sort of ways of looking at it, ways of approaching it, ways of seeing, without them being anything other than like little signposts along the road. It's something we can only experience. And it arises naturally from our practice. And this is something I've heard Joseph say, this isn't advanced practice. This is just what arises in practice. And we all have little moments of this all the time, where things are going still and quiet, and there's just, if we look, they'd be like, where's the self here? Let's just not. And then over time, we just gradually, hopefully, make that connection more often. One other thing from Joseph Goldstein there. And this is from a section early in this book, Mindfulness, where he's talking about the momentum of mindfulness. There's an early insight into the nature of the mind-body process that comes from this continuity of mindfulness and also strengthens it. It is the understanding through one's own experience that in every moment knowing and its object arise simultaneously. So knowing and the object we're knowing are there at the same moment. There is the in-breath and the simultaneous knowing of it, the out-breath and the knowing of it. The visual object arises, and in that very moment there is a knowing of it. This is true of every aspect of our experience. This insight is the first doorway into the understanding of selflessness, and it's the stage of insight. It is called purification of view. We begin to see that everything that we call self is simply this pairwise progression of knowing and object, arising and passing moment after moment. And we also see that knowing in each moment arises due to impersonal causes, and not because there is some abiding knower. So we can say that knowing consciousness arises spontaneously when the appropriate causes and conditions are present. It's a pretty dense philosophy here. Going even deeper, we see that the knowing faculty is not altered or affected by what is known. Going even deeper, we see that the knowing faculty is not altered or affected by what is known. And this realization has liberating consequences for both our meditation practice and our lives. In meditation, as we go from painful sensation to pleasant ones, we see that the basic quality of knowing is not altered. It's simply aware of what is arising. One example of the profound consequences of this understanding is the description of Henry David Thoreau's last days. He died of tuberculosis at the early age of 44. In a biography of his life, his friend described his frame of mind. Henry was never affected, never reached by his illness. Very often I heard him tell his visitors that he enjoyed existence as well as ever. He remarked to me that there was as much comfort in perfect disease as in perfect health. The mind always conforming to the condition of the body. The thought of death, he said, could not begin to trouble him. During his illness, I never heard a murmur escape him, or the slightest wish expressed to remain with us. His perfect contentment was truly wonderful. Some of his more orthodox friends and relatives tried to prepare him for death, but with little satisfaction for themselves. When his Aunt Louisa asked him if he had made his peace with God, he answered, "I didn't know we'd ever quarreled, Aunt." It's like the lightness of it. It's what he says, how light you can be. And that's part of not getting caught in the sense of self, is that there's a lightness to it all that is quite wonderful. One more. More tidbits from Mark Epstein here. And he's talking about how when we stop blaming, which we do all the time, and start just accepting, how this is such a profound change. The movement from grievance to gratitude is the essence of what the confluence of Buddhism and psychotherapy engenders. Yes, it is important to make sense of one's personal experiences, to face all of the distressing aspects of one's history, to name the abuses and traumas and neglect, to one's own shame, anger, addictive cravings, and self-low esteem that one identify as co-leased around as a result. So all these things that we identify as who I am. But it's important to know that one does not have to be defined by these things. This is the key here. So we have to acknowledge them, but not let them be who I am, not let them create my sense of a separate self. To hold them all lightly, in the way a mother holds a baby, is to let an underlying, fundamental, and interpersonally entangled benevolence shine through. Eventually, through the peeling away of over-elaborated and often punitive self-concepts, one discovers that this underlying truth is accessible, even in the midst of everyday difficulties. This is the gate of oneness. A doorway that is nothing but open space. And then he concludes. This is the last two paragraphs of this book, which I absolutely love. If we are to be truly compassionate with ourselves and with others, we can and must survive the worst. What could be more true? Intensity of living and risks. Risk of openness. What can be better? As a patient of mine once quipped when speaking of how writing her memoir had helped her deal with a sudden and unimaginable tragedy that had upended her life, writing is as much a better quality of agony than trying to forget. Acknowledging things. The same might be said of both meditation and psychotherapy. They encourage a willingness to face the horrors of life, those that dwell within and those imposed from without, with a courage and trust that can be hard to otherwise muster. We cannot erase our histories, no matter how hard we try, but in learning to face them with kindness, as so many of my patients have been able to do, we enter the stream that flows gently, if not always merrily, towards inner peace. I like that acknowledgement from the last sentence. It flows gently, if not always merrily, toward inner peace. And of course, I have a little bit of poetry that expresses this in one other way. This is Dana Fald's from her book Going In, this poem called Setting Forth. And it's talking about this experience of letting go of the sense of a separate self and what that entails in some sense. It's called Setting Forth. Something will be born from this goodbye. In the pain of setting forth, something will die. With the release of the old comes a moment when nothing is firmly held, and the unknown burns the bridges of the past. When the smoke clears, my eyes seek out the new horizon. Nothing is known here, but the air is sweet, and breathing deeply, I see long dormant seeds send up their shoots from the fertile ground of change. As leaves unfurl to meet the sun, the circle is complete. I will not forget a single step of this sacred journey, nor will I let comfort lock me in its warm embrace. I do not know what fruits these seeds will bear, but I have faith that what is taking root today will surprise me with its vigor. In birth and death, the in-breath and the final exhalation, there is pain and the movement into truth. I take the step that I am called to, even if I do not know the final destination. Courage to find. So that's what I have to share with you.